Some people just like have a transcendent experience. They don't even have a practice. It just happens to them. Some people practice towards that and a transcendent experience happens, and they haven't really matured the psychological relational piece. So they'll have to do that to have a balanced, quote, enlightenment. Other people, they do the psychological relational, and that provides an optimal foundation to work with the transcendent. However, for some of those people who have a mature psychological relational, they may not have a driver or an impulse to go to the transcendent. So there's that. So whether, sometimes there's this question of, well, should I do the psychological relational first or the transcendent first? And we don't always get to choose.
Hi, I'm Ricky DeRiz, and welcome to episode 41 of the Mind That Ego podcast. Haprakash Khalsa started as a student of Zen meditation in 1984 and went on to become a certified Kundalini yoga instructor and teacher of mindfulness meditation in the systematic style of Shinzen Young, whom Haprakash has studied intensively with since 1999. He has written Cultivate in the Jewel of Mindfulness, a comprehensive practitioner curriculum, offers private online mindfulness coaching, and supervises solo retreatants at his off-grid farm near Owen Sound, Ontario. Our conversation covers a spectrum from suffering to enlightenment, from core wounds to Buddha nature, in an approach that will resonate with seasoned practitioners and those looking to relate better to themselves and others. Topics include the value of introspection, the scale of meaning, cultivating wholesome states, embracing the full human experience, and the key markers of balanced awakening. And just a reminder before we jump into the conversation to please like, rate, subscribe, and share to help more people access the podcast. Enjoy. I want to kick us off with what might sound like a bit of an oxymoron. And I just wanted an excuse to use the word oxymoron, to be honest. But this idea of integrating enlightenment, this is enlightenment is a word with a lot of connotations. And I'd like
Sure.
for us to explore that seeming paradox between the two, and we can venture from that point of departure into different areas. But I wonder to begin if you could give your view and your perspective on enlightenment, and then we can move on to the integration aspect.
Sure. Lots of ways to talk about it, but one way to talk about it is it's enlightenment is a the process of enlightenment is really an acclimatization to more and more attenuated states. And by attenuated states, I mean, one way to talk about it is to talk about kind of the conventional way of being in the world, person, place, and thing. And then there's a more subtle way of interfacing with the self and world and the selfing process. And then there's a very subtle way of that happening. And over time, the sense of having a solid, fixed self in the conventional way that most people think about it, frame it, that changes to more of an energetic process that gets finer and finer, subtler and subtler. And so it becomes more of a selfing process, so to speak. And that self in the selfing process is more at times solid and at times seemingly not there at all. And when that sense of, yeah, there's awareness beyond the usual surface body mind, when that really shifts for a person, that's one way to talk about enlightenment. Literally, if we think about the word and we just flip it a little bit, it's not in heavy meant. People think when they say enlightenment, they think like the light, so to speak. Whereas you could think about it as weight. And so what changes is there's a shift from this like enheaviment to the lightness of being. And the lightness of being is very freeing.
I really like that description. Yeah, like enlightenment in terms of fine tuning, almost like tuning into less dense forms of consciousness and moving
Yeah,
away from.
and traditionally that's associated with what was called the process of purification. So working through the craving, aversion, unconsciousness piece, and then as a person works through that, that both reveals more wholesome body mind states, and also gives us an opportunity. It makes it a little easier to find and cultivate those wholesome states as well.
And within that process, how would you talk to interconnection and oneness or non-duality, as it is often referred to?
Okay, so now we're starting to sling the lingo. We're starting to get into some terminology. So I'd like to ask you, what do you mean when you say non-duality?
Thanks for asking me that question, because I do think it is important to be precise to avoid confusion. So for me, I use that terminology almost as shorthand, because I know that a lot of people practicing meditation, maybe with a certain interest in Buddhism or Hinduism or Vedanta, so it is a bit of shorthand. But for me, the not two element is uncovering, connecting to, realizing the foundational essence of being that is that again, language, but permeates or is the essence of everything. I don't know if that if that's a good answer to that question, but really the foundation of interconnection, not just an intellectual understanding, but a foundational contact with the base of reality in that sense.
And oh, so now you brought in the term reality. Okay.
I like this. Bit of semantic cleansing through this.
Because Shenzhen Yang has been my main teacher, he's a real stickler for terminology.
Good. Yeah.
And the idea being that there's much confusion. And much sometimes, contentious disagreement when people are using perhaps the same word in different ways. So I just want to get on the same page because I've watched a couple of your YouTube videos, which I really like,
Yeah, thank you.
and the word non-duality is used a lot. And so you also say reality. So I just want to be clear about what you mean by that. So what do you mean by reality now?
So I really appreciate you asking me these questions. My background as a writer as well. It really is. It's good to be reminded of that clarity. Reality for me encompasses what is or existence. So reality in the sense of what truly exists. And within that, I'm conscious of using another word that I've then got to define, but within that framework of what exists, encompassing both like the personal my subjective experience of the, I guess, the boundaries of reality, so the field of reality that I experience, and a conceptual intellectual understanding of how most people explain what existence is or what the framework is. That would
Okay.
be my shot at describing reality. Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's not actually a word that I use very often.
Okay.
I just prefer to use sensory experience. And then what a person makes of that, that's their business. And sensory experience can happen at gross, subtle, or very subtle scales. And there's the sensory, quote, sensory experience, and then there's our relationship to the sensory experience and what happens. So in a way, the sensory experience, whether it's gross, subtle, or very subtle, is a kind of content or energy at the subtler scales. And then there's the relationship to that, or the relationship that becomes that.
Yeah. But the idea of the observer and the observed on one level, objects within a field of awareness in some sense, that'd be accurate.
Depending on what stage of the process you're at.
Yeah. I like to just follow this right now because I know for some people we might have just gone gone straight into this minutia, but that's quite common for people learning meditation to tune into what we'd label awareness of thoughts, sensations as objects. But am I right in understanding that, as you say, depending on the stage, there's a point where even that sense of being a thing aware of objects changes.
Yeah, it's talked about in various traditions. So if we want to use the yogic, to see this is where we get into terminology. If we want to use the yogic term samadhi versus the Buddhist term samadhi. So in Buddhism, samadhi means concentration, but in the yogic terminology, samadhi is a kind of concentration, but it's broken down into samadhi with seed and samadhi without seed. And those are two very different experiences. So, samadhi with seed is you, quote, become absorbed into the object. And in a way, you participate as the object, except the object is a verb. It's not a noun. That's one way of talking about samadhi with seed. It's talked about other ways, but let's just use that for now. Samadhi without seed is you're not just, quote, merging with an object. There is no object. So when there is no object, that's called various things. I like to just call it pure awareness. So that's another way of using that, the terminology in this case of samadhi. So we just need to be kind of clear about that experience. But then there's one another experience where it's not just, okay, there's pure awareness. And by pure awareness, the qualities of pure awareness are it's outside of time and space. So there isn't any seeming duration that you're aware of because there's no you in pure awareness. But there also, as far as space goes, there's no left, right, up, down, front, back, no gravity. That's what I mean by pure awareness. But there's this other piece where you are, quote, you are in touch with pure awareness while you're bopping around the town, taking care of business. And if we want to use the word non-dual, then I would use the word in that context.
Yeah.
And another way to say that is in temporal processing, it takes about half a second, roughly speaking, for us to recognize a person, place, or thing in the conventional world as a person, place, or thing, roughly speaking. But on the way to that half second, if we see, quote, a person, that seeing goes through a bunch of processing stations within that half a second. However, over time, when we become sensitive, we auger back towards earlier temporal processing. So, what is pre-conscious for most people, we can begin to detect. So, if you're detecting, let's say, a third of a second, and on the way to half a second to the conventional world, then my way of talking about that is okay, now you're aware of the subtle scale. But there's an even subtler scale where it's, I don't know what it is. I'm gonna leave it to the neuroscientists. This is all kind of conjecture on my part, but there is some research on this. I just think we need more. Let's say you can detect 10th of a second. 10th of a second is now very subtle. And that earliest temporal processing combined with the half a second or conventional processing that most people have in the world, that's another way to talk about non-dual. And there's even some terminology that seems to align with that, like the Tibetans, they have a term called that translates into what's called one taste. And at that, my conjecture is that that earliest temporal processing is the detection of one taste. So when you're bopping about in the world, when everything seems to have equal value, is one way to put it, and you can sense that, my conjecture is that's the earliest temporal processing plus the later conventional way we process. And you get the sense of, oh, everything's kind of equal. Everything has equal value. And anyway, so that's one way to talk about these things.
No, I really appreciate again the precision, because as you share that, I'm using that to contextualize some of my own experiences that I struggle to contextualize after experiencing them. And that experience of, as you say, equal value, but experiencing without the conceptual mind placing its own templates over experience,
This is,
almost.
see that conceptual mind would be more than half a second. Because the first recognition of, hey, person, place, or thing in the conventional world, let's say if that's half a second, and now we're going to think about that my conjecture is even longer temporal processing. So in a way, what we're doing in spiritual work is we're auguring back an earlier temporal processing, but at the same time, we want to include the half second or more in the conventional world because that's part of integration.
And sanity.
Absolutely. That's called a balanced enlightenment.
Right, yeah. I like, yeah, that's such a, that's awesome. It, yeah, it doesn't make sense in this phrasing really, but the sanitization of phenomena, which is so essential, like to, without that, for example, say someone that's taken psychedelics and they've had a complete ego dissolution. I would imagine, and it's not necessarily the same in terms of the sharpness of filter in or experience in reality, but there can be no, or a lack of the ability to conceptually contextualize everything going on, which can lead to just like, what is this weird kind of phenomenological experiences because of that lack of the intellect in its kind of appropriate place.
But see,
Almost.
that's not a true ego dissolution then.
It, yeah, okay, this is good. This is good. I like this. Yeah. Right.
A
Could you explain
true
more about
ego,
that?
sure,
Yeah.
a true ego dissolution is a true transcendent experience, which means there's no you to experience it. So, in other words, you become, quote, the activity of whatever you're experiencing. That's what happens with ego dissolution. However, at some point, the quote, the regular self or the conceptual self or the conventional self comes back and either reacts to that true transcendent experience or tries to claim it for itself.
Within that, would you define some quality? Because you say that there's no self, but the distinction between.
In that moment, there's no quote egoic conventional self.
But there's still the sanity of understanding, like I'm Ricky, I'm in the world.
No,
You'd say
it's a
without
true
that as well.
transcendent experience.
Yeah.
If there's any sense of, I'm Ricky or I'm Harprakash in the world, that is not a true transcendent experience. There's no you in a true transcendent experience.
I appreciate that there's no, experientially, there's no you, but is there an
There's
ability to think or to un to because otherwise that's insanity, right? Or like psychosis.
no.
How would you, this is what I'm interested in. How, so why is it not? So if you are in a transcendent experience and there's no ability to cognize I am or to
If
understand.
there's reactivity or thinking about, then that's not a true transcendent experience. It's not a quote, you mentioned like the dissolution of the ego specifically. So if we, again, we're slinging lingo here. So if what we mean by ego is a sense of self that includes thinking about things or reacting to things, then just logically, any kind of thinking about a transcendent experience is after the fact or not a true transcendent experience. Or if a conventional self or egoic self, quote, manifests after a true transcendent experience and then gets freaked out, that's not a true transcendent experience. That's a reaction to what was beyond time and space. And now the reaction is happening in a conventional way with a conventional ego in time and space, with the pressures of time and space, which are creating part of the reactivity. But a true transcendent experience, you're free from all that because there's no you. There's no problems because there's no you. But there's also no sense of this is great, this is fantastic, because there's still a little you there, and
Yeah.
that's happening.
In because I to I'm struggling to bring this into like away from the terminology, but when you describe like a transcendent experience, are
I'm
you
talking
talking of
about the absolute pure transcendent experience that does not have any kind of selfing process involved with it, because there's no you to have a selfing process.
do you mean in sort of in a state or a meditation or walking around in the world?
Either.
Okay, so if walking around in the world, if experience it, you're walking around, you're doing your thing, and there's no experience of you and no cognition of you, if someone says your name, do you respond to that? And if you do respond, what is the part of you in that moment that is able to recognize your name? Does that make sense?
Great question.
Yeah.
Well, again, I want to distinguish between a pure awareness, transcendent experience that has no objects. So we say, to go back to the other way that I was framing it, we might say it's just the earliest temporal processing that's happening. However, when you're bopping about the world, it isn't just the earliest temporal processing. It's that you may be able to detect, and whatever processing needs to happen to recognize and be functional in the conventional world. So those are related, but they're two different birds.
Yeah, which would that, because that satisfies for me the, and I'm a stickler for this just because of my curiosity and experience around like mental illness and psychosis, and exploring that fine line between enlightenment and mysticism and psychosis and where that true line is. So I think these kind of discussions are really important because, you know, someone who is in an extreme psychosis and perhaps someone in a psychedelic trip, in a bad trip, might not respond to their name. Their sense of self might be so, they're like, wait, what? And confusion's there. But what you're talking to, it's not confusion, right? It's actually clarity, abundant clarity. Yeah.
It's just vastly expanded now beyond the conventional self. It inc then that's the that's the trick. I mean, that's the that's how you can tell if it's how integrated it is, because, you know, as Mr. Ken Wilber likes to say, if you're going to transcend, you have to include. So it's not like the conventional world or the conventional self goes away. You can still function in it. It's just vastly attenuated. It's lightened up. So, and those are the kind of the two markers of integration, as Shenzhen likes to talk about it, and how I conceive it also, which is, how fulfilling is this experience? And then how functional are you? And if either one of those is off, then that becomes part of the practice, is how do we turn this into a good functional experience?
Yeah. And that is that, I mean, that's arguably the big, or one of the biggest markers of sanity is functionality, because culturally we define sanity based on how we're meeting society's standard of functioning, right? Like someone, if you can't work, for example, yeah, that's a common one. If you're unable to work, if you're unable to meet the demands of life in a certain way, that might be seen as being mentally ill or not functioning. I'd be interested, so within that, and you mentioned Ken Wilber, and we kind of touched upon a really important topic around this paradox almost of a stable self and the value of a stable self in transcending the self, in that inclusion, like including a stable self.
Yeah, and I would call that a functional self. I wouldn't call it a stable self. A
Good, yeah.
functional self that has adult agency. In other words, you've done your psychological relational work, and to use some of that Wilbur terminology, you've done your grow up piece, which enables you to, you know, depending on how far you want to unpack this, you've done sufficient cleanup within the growing up, opening up within the growing up, and actually showing up to your life and responsibilities and to your and to so that you can manifest your goals, you know, so that you can make your contribution, sing your song, you know, live your gift, whatever unique is unique to you, and how that connects to other people. That's fully showing up. That's the functionality part.
Is that for you as well, the reason why there's that word integration can come with enlightenment? Because, and I'm kind of, it's kind of a loaded question, but enlightenment, does that equate a full transformation of our wounding, our trauma, our attachment styles, or
Of
is
course
there? Yeah, I
not.
led you into that
Well,
one.
that's why there's, you know, I the simple way I like to put it, again, using some Wilbur terms, is we need to integrate the grow up piece with the wake up piece, understanding that the grow up piece also includes this, you know, cleaning up or the shadow work or the opening up, which one way to interpret that is to be become a person of complete feeling, to be able to do that, which, by the way, becoming a person of complete feeling means that you broke the addiction to thinking, because thinking is the glass ceiling for emotions. Emotions come up, and when thinking comes in, they like hit the glass ceiling and they can't fully express themselves and then die back where they came out of. So it includes that also in the maturation process, which is a tall order, because, you know, my mantra is my homework for the rest of my life is, can I feel the full range of my emotions at all intensities, in all situations, and here comes the agency piece, and still behave appropriately? That's roughly speaking, becoming a person of complete feeling and also becoming an admirable person. Those are two Shinzen terms, by the way.
No, I like that. How do you, this is something I'm working with now, like how do you, in terms of fully feeling, because you have the, again, like I'm hyper aware of language now, but like how we define emotion linguistically, or how we label emotion, but then the subjective experience of energy moving in different ways. I know some traditions look at that in terms of like the elements, fire, water, air, etc. How do you work with the intensity of energy? Like just in my experience, like the more I've opened up, the more intense that energy can be at times,
The more
and
you're gonna feel.
the more you're going to feel, exactly, the more you're going to
Yeah,
feel,
you become more alive.
you become more alive, exactly.
Yeah, and there's a price to pay for becoming alive, and that's called feeling.
Right, exactly. And the feeling,
Hence becoming a person of complete feeling.
but that's also contrasted with a suppressed society, right? Like so, sometimes that contrast, I don't know if you experienced this, but I had this conversation in the last recording that I had around sometimes being on public transport and this feeling of like, where I feel so much energy and I look around and I feel like I just want to break the fourth wall of that experience and just be like, guys, we're all here, we're all alive. But because of my own mechanisms, like my psychological relational mechanisms, I think from that feeling of aliveness and from that feeling of this is a lot, have both confused that as panic or like anxiety. But I think sometimes it is actually just energy that's there. But you mentioned the glass ceiling. It's almost like I put a glass ceiling on that energy and it becomes constricted anxiety.
Yeah, that's the story around it.
Exactly. Yeah. And how that story manipulates the energy in a way.
And then the well, this story mixes with the emotion, the original emotion, and then changes the original emotion by ramping it up or adding other emotions to it. And then you get like mirrors reflecting each other, and it's like a runaway train off down a track at that point. But part of what you're talking about is at the conventional scale, or to use the gross, subtle, and very subtle lingo, at the gross scale, there's, happy, sad, glad, mad, those kinds of emotions. However, at the subtle scale, it's not just emotion, it's energy in motion. And then at a very subtle, it's even finer energy in motion that is literally winking in and out of existence moment by moment. So, what scale do you want to talk about emotion on? If you're on public transit and you're experiencing emotion as energy, like great, but you're also in the conventional world. So if you're gonna talk to people, you're gonna like be saying to them, okay, jump out of the conventional system here, the conventional way of thinking and talking about and feeling emotion. And now that we've jumped out of that system, wow, everything's scintillating and vibrating and moving, and isn't it amazing? And they're going to be like, huh? Okay. So context is important. And part of what one way to frame things is that you mentioned the word paradox. One way to think about the paradox is that there's multiple perspectives at any given moment. And you're going to have one perspective in you, if you're interfacing in the conventional world. You're going to have a different perspective if you're experiencing all phenomenon, all sensory events as energy. And when those two, or to even to chunk it down further, you're also going to have a different perspective that gets flavored if pure awareness, if the earliest temporal processing is mixing with either the energetic component of at the subtle scale or the conventional person, place, thing world. And so the ability to have all that simultaneously and still function in the conventional world and also to be fulfilled while that's happening, that's one way to talk about the integration.
I really like that.
We get confused when we have different perspectives and we kind of weigh them one against the other when they all have something, they all have value in their own way. And so, can we have them all just be a part of each other? And eventually, that can happen over time with enough practice.
I'm not sure how familiar you are with systems theory, like complex systems. This might sound like
A little bit,
a
but go
little,
for
that's probably enough because I'm not that clued up. But basically this, because I know Ken Wilber talks about this, but it's making me think of like a holarchy or a holistic system where like the
the nested, yeah. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
so this,
Absolutely. The
yeah, it's a similar.
very subtle is within the subtle, and the very subtle and the subtle is within the gross or the conventional. Absolutely.
Within that, there's the argument of, oh, well, it goes like they're self-contained, but as you build up, you require what is below it. That's why it's the holarchy. So the
That's the transcend and
subtle,
include.
So they're all, that whole system's included in that because to have the subtle, you need the very subtle.
Yeah.
So it's like it's almost like through the experience of. Subjectively experiencing, and this is conjecture, but almost like the subatomic level of experience. But then, as you say, the gross in terms of framing, context, a life story, some kind of narrative, which is very
Life goals,
life
you
goals,
know.
exactly. Like how do you break that down into atoms and make sense of it? It's like this weird scale up kind of experience. And it does make sense if I can imagine the way that you're talking about this in terms of like the integration aspect is really cool, because this does make sense, that fine line with madness or divine madness, or the moments where, like one example, like with a Kundalini awakening and having loads of energy, there can be at times like a disconnect from consensus reality. And it might be an experience of something that feels incredibly true subjectively, but it doesn't have that ability to contextualize, as you mentioned. It's almost as if when integrated, enlightenment is like hypersanity, is beyond, I mean, whether conventional sanity is sane, but there's like a level above like you say, includes everything before it and also is transcends it at the same time.
Sounds good.
Yeah, sounds like a good goal to have, doesn't it?
Well, part of, see, you know, people talk about, you know, like there's this expression, term, the meaning crisis, right? So people talk about like what's meaningful, right? And then when I hear that, I immediately think, at which scale? So there's meaning in the conventional world. And then there's, if you can know yourself, quote, in quotations, at the deepest level, as a kind of original nature, Buddha nature, primordial perfection, pick your favorite word. If you can know yourself like that, there's a kind of meaning and fulfillment that happens that's independent of the other conventional or the you know the gross or the subtle or all that. It's independent of that, and yet it's also interdependent with that as it's integrated. And so in other words, you can fully show up to your life. And no matter what the outcomes are, you can feel a fundamental okayness.
That's cool. Yeah.
And then in a way that's very much, it's a little bit like what the punchline quote is in the Bhagavad Gita, which is to, you know, well, my down and dirty way of saying it is, you know, do your best and leave the rest. Kind of thing. And the leave the rest is like, yeah, you've done your job, you've shown up in the world, you're functional, and whether it works out or not, you still have fundamental okayness. You don't need to take that on beyond what you know, you've beyond showing up and doing your thing. And those are like when the two are together.
Yeah.
Fundamental okayness, even though you're trying to, you can refine the self, you can become a better person, you can improve your character, you can improve your behaviors, you can improve the wholesome qualities, you can be more skilled in whatever it is you're doing, you can develop all that stuff. And there's this fundamental okayness that's not subject to any of that.
It's almost like to use that visualization. If almost, say, at the subatomic level, if you have meaning at a subatomic level, because all of these other layers are made of that and build upon it, it scales up. But and this is where I could lose my own kind of analogy. And we spend a lot of time seeking meaning at a gross level, and that's still worthwhile and important, of course, but it doesn't necessarily scale back down in the same way if you're not connected
Well,
to those deeper levels.
that's the difference between you know, basically being a muggle and being a wizard.
Yeah.
So people that are limited to the conventional self and the conventional world, I mean, they're like stuck in the matrix, so to speak. And one way to think about enlightenment or liberation is you're not limited to that. So you're freed from the prison of that. And once the experience happens beyond the usual way that we identify with the body and mind, in other words, we auger back into earlier temporal processing, we start to have experiences of the body and mind that are very thinned out or changing or thinned out and changing. And then even that disappears. And even the sensory spaces that that was in disappear. Now we've lost time and space. Now we've touched into that, quote, pure awareness. But even that, even that can disappear, pure awareness. And then, roughly speaking, when that happens, at least according to the early Buddhism, the Theravada four path model, if you have a sufficient experience of that complete Nirodha or cessation of even pure awareness, then roughly speaking, that's equated with like the first stage in the four stage model in Theravada Buddhism of enlightenment. So we can talk about sensory experience at many scales. And also the disappearance of sensory experience.
Well, when you use the term like disappearance and even pure awareness disappearing, something that always comes to mind for me is like, is that not death?
Sure. Well, of course it is, but it's not the death the way that we usually think about it.
Could you explain the difference between those two?
Well, sure. We're constantly being, quote, birthed and dying moment by moment by moment. Experience at a very fine scale is winking in and out of existence over and over again. It's a little bit like the alternating current cycle of a light. So, when in the alternating current cycle, there's like, I think it's 60, like 60 off and ons. And the 60 pulses of off and on, when we look at the light, that's just like a continuous light. But that's at the gross scale. If we look at it finer, that light is winking in and out of existence 60 times a second. But you have to be sensitive enough to be able to detect that kind of thing. And that's preconscious for most people. It's the same with the 24 frames per second in the in a movie. It's like that gate is like closing and opening, closing and opening, closing and opening. And we take these 24 frames to be continuous, but they're not. They're 24 frames. That's broken. So, at a very subtle scale, at a very fine scale, perceptually, there's like, you can like look out at the world, and you can, at sometimes some people can look out at the world and be able to interface at different scales. And one of those scales is the winking in and out of existence over and over again. And that's a kind of death that happens with life. And they exist together. It's a dialectic that's constantly happening. It's just that most people aren't sensitive enough to detect that or could care less about it,
One of the two. You mentioned like looking out into the world. In those Like, how does that affect perception? Like, would it be the equivalent of completely slowing down the frame rate of a movie? So to use our earlier framing, it's almost like you'd lose the gross level if you're really zooming in, or is it somehow coexistent that you can sense the flickering in and out whilst maintaining the gross? So, for example, I'm looking out the window. I see this form that I label a tree. Don't know how quickly I caught that in my sensory perception, but would I still see a tree, or would I just see a completely pixelated flickering thing that
Yes.
I'd, yeah. Would it so with that pixelated flickering thing, is there still form there, or is it even more minute than form itself, if that makes sense?
Well, it's different perspectives at multiple scales that
Yeah.
can simultaneously be there. So if I'm looking out now, depending on how I follow my nose, I can, know I'm sitting in my living room, or I can like look out the window at the escarpment out the window, or I can, look beside me and see my dog, cowboy that's there, right? So all that I can interface and function with in a conventional way. And if we want to chunk down the ladder of
Yeah.
subtlety, then I can look out and I can notice that what appear to be objects in the room or the, walls of the room itself, they're very slowly undulating. And we could talk about the reasons for that, but just for now, let's keep going. Or I can look out and I can see that anytime, well, as a whole field, it's completely pixelated and all those pixels are winking in and out of existence. Or I can notice that if I'm looking here, and then I either shift my eyes or tilt my head and look there, that the scene that was here, as I shift to this scene, as this scene expands in my awareness, this scene goes to zero. And that's a kind of dance of simultaneous expansion and contraction that's always happening. Or I can notice the entire field. It's just like at a very super subtle scale is winking in and out of existence. So those are just different ways that can open up for people. And they, once they're integrated, it's like, well, what do you want to pay attention to? Now they do overlap at times. So, quote, I can see the tree as a tree, or I mean, sometimes I just like literally play with awareness. So like I do what I call do scales. So exactly what I said. So I look at the tree. Oh yeah, there's a tree, and that's why is that one dead? Wonder if it got infected by, da 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 da, all that. I can do all that stuff, conceptual thinking, blah blah. Or I can do that scale that I just mentioned of now it's not a noun. Now it's a verb. And so that verb is changing, and at what scale is it changing? And does it get to the scale where it's an abrupt version of change, where it's actually arising or passing at any given moment? And then what is, quote, below the arising or passing, or what is the arising out of, and what is the passing into? So that's what I call playing scales.
I
Some
love
people play
that.
piano,
Yeah. Play scales of perception.
I'm no good at piano.
I think the perception one's better, to be honest, more fun. Like,
That's your bias.
that is my bias for sure, because I can't play piano either. So I am really interested in this, because My awakening, I don't want to just lump it in with one sensory experience, but a profound shift that was like, well, for me, was in the visual field.
Sure.
And like you're describing, I genuinely felt like I'm seeing now for the first time. And there are so many different labels, terms that I could use. One that does, and I've had it because I was kind of stable in that state. And then I've just been under, in more recent times, a lot of stress. And I think the emotional stress has dimmed that. And the last few weeks, it's kind of returned with even more clarity. And it's fucking amazing, basically.
So is that
But
how you're seeing now as we're talking?
yeah, to some extent, and like an experience of.
Well, hold on. So when you're seeing, quote, you're looking at the screen and you're seeing a picture of me, that's at the conventional scale.
Yeah.
However, you also have this other way of seeing.
The
If
way I
that's
just.
available to you, you're starting to have the ability to play scales or to be able to interface with experience at gross, subtle, and then eventually very subtle scales.
Yeah, there's what's becoming more noticeable for me is the spaciousness. So this the field of space.
That's also the light as opposed to the heavy. In
Yeah,
enlightenment.
exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's
And
the attenuation.
yes.
And the integration is the acclimatization of that attenuation.
Yes, because that's the thing. Like for me, when it for I call it, I use the word enchanted quite a lot because it's like accompanying it. It's I guess the idea of like emptiness and form, but there's a visual shift and an experience of both at the same time spaciousness, but then like a effervescent like emanating quality from what I was observing. I don't know if that makes sense. What you
Well, that's a
describe.
kind of so we could, talk about spaciousness or degrees of spaciousness, or we could talk about emptiness, or we could talk about pure awareness, or we could talk about pure awareness as it's, quote, integrated with the subtle or the gross or the conventional. We could talk about all that. And when that's flavored, when that's not pure emptiness, that's what I call it, just flavored.
Yeah.
And there's equivalent terms to this, way of perceiving. So in Christianity, there's this term called the beatific vision.
Oh, nice. That is
So that
cool.
enchantment is kind of a beatific vision.
Yeah.
And the beatific vision, the thing to just know about that is that it's not limited to the usual conventions in the conventional world. So it's not like I prefer this rose because that's prettier than this daisy. It's the toilet, the garbage can, the compost, as well as the rose.
Yeah.
And that's part of that one taste or that equality of experience.
Yeah, because that it is like thinking of even ancient Greek and like Platonic ideas of like beauty and truth. It's almost like that tapping into the inherent beauty that does not discriminate dependent on the object. It just
Which
emanates.
is at a different, quote, scale than the
Yeah.
conventional world, and yet overlays and interfaces with the conventional world.
Yeah.
So that's part of the integration, but that's a flavored integration.
Yeah. And I think I'm enjoying it. Maybe a bit being a bit selfish because I'm asking questions, personal ones that I'm really finding interesting, but I have felt conceptually confused around like emptiness, stillness, and then that flavor. almost a relationship with this experience of enchantment, where I felt not overly, because I did get attached. I was completely got attached to it, and then
Sure.
craved its, when it went missing, and
It's common.
yeah,
When we
it's.
go through this shift, it becomes, there's a difference between it being integrated and it first appearing. And when it
Yeah.
first appears, we have either, positive, negative, or a combination of those reactions to it. But eventually, those reactions settle down, and then it becomes the new normal.
Yeah.
And then we've shifted from a peak experience to something that is more installed. It's like it's an abiding experience. It's always available to us if we just point our nose in that direction. And sometimes regarding the flavoring of emptiness, sometimes the well, a couple of things about that. So one is pure emptiness is pure emptiness. However, pure emptiness, because the usual craving, aversion, and consciousness is not operational, by default, the wholesome states are more available, the wholesome mind-body states. So
Yeah.
because they're more available, they'll either spontaneously appear and color that emptiness, like in the beatific vision, or we can just like insert through our attention a tiny drop of whatever. If it's pure emptiness and you can put a tiny drop of joy in, that joy is gonna flavor that emptiness, the field of emptiness. It might be super subtle because that concentrated drop is gonna spread, but it's there. And you can at some point have that ability to just drop that in anytime you want. So there's kind of two, in the Tibetan system, there's two differing schools. And one school is, okay, if you just like work through the craving, aversion, and unconsciousness, or sometimes they're called the mula kleshas. So mula means root, klesha means a quote impurity. So if you just work through that, then all the wholesome mind-body states will be there. So that's one school. But the Dalai Lama actually disagrees with that. He says, well, yeah, some of those will be revealed, but it's also our job to further cultivate the ones that are revealed, but also to cultivate the ones that aren't revealed. And I like that. That's what I've found to be true in my own experience. And so sometimes joy will just like happen out of the emptiness because there isn't the usual mula kleshas or craving, aversion, unconsciousness that's getting in the way of that. And at other times, I could be walking around and everything's kind of like one taste, it's fairly even. It's all a part of everything else, including the perception piece. And then it's like, okay, if I see something and I just notice what's pleasant about that, or I just drop in some kind of, let's say, positive feel, positive emotion, then all of a sudden that's flavoring emptiness, and that's easily doable with practice.
Is that when you say drop in and the practice of that, is it similar to like the cultivation of, if you're,
Yeah.
it's almost like you're remembering joy or like evoking joy, and because you're at a state of exalted consciousness, to use more terminology, taken out from like the Yoga Sutras, but then it saturates your field, and you're actually consciously choosing to cultivate that.
Yeah, it's both. It's both. Wholesome mind-body states will reveal themselves spontaneously sometimes. And at other times, it'll just be like this equality of one taste. And at other times, you can intentionally drop in something pleasant, let's say, and have that color the field.
To I'm really I this conversation's going really fast. I think we probably won't cover everything that I'd like to, and I'm wondering if you'd be up for another conversation at some point as well, because there's a lot I feel if that's something you'd be interested in.
Yeah, sure, I'm open.
Because I'm thinking with that as well, the flip side, or not the flip side, but in this context of what you're talking to, there's this like saturation of state, but there's also a more gross, more conventional experience of like psychological projection that people have to kind of tap into that Jungian model. How, and I get, in this context you're talking to, I would imagine that they're the impurities that are then appearing in the field. How, and if this question doesn't make sense, and I'll ask another one, but how would you frame that in terms of noticing projections and noticing when what is appearing in your environment is actually coming from like a seed or a belief, some kind of distortion, compared to this experience you're talking to where there's an emptiness and an arising of positive experience, which isn't, it doesn't seem to me the same as projection because it's coming from consciousness rather than like.
Well, everything, one, again, there's lots of ways to talk about this, but one way is everything is a fabrication. So that's one way to think about it. Everything is, all experience is constructed of various elements. So that's what I mean by fabrication. Now, the fabrication can be less clouded. It can be clear or not. And again, it depends on what skill we're talking about. If we're talking about the psychological relational piece of around projection, then we have to kind of be able to work through our, well, our mula kleshas or the craving, aversion, unconsciousness, which colors those projections. And it depends at what scale. If you want to talk about it at the psychological relational scale, well, okay, maybe you do ideal parent work with the through the ideal parent protocol. Maybe you work with subpersonalities and internal family systems. Maybe you work through your schemas or your core beliefs, all to say you work towards, quote, earning a secure attachment. As you earn a secure attachment, or as you grow more adult agency, you're going to project less and less and less. So that would be a way of doing it psychologically. It's a lot of, reality testing. I mean, you can even think about if you imagine a person is like feeling or thinking something, you can check it out, do a reality check. Or as we introspect and become a connoisseur of our own mind body behavioral conditioning, then we can work more and more with what is coming into consciousness, or we can also encourage certain things that are below the threshold of consciousness to come up through the repression barrier. And there's various techniques to do that. And then we can work through that little by little. But we can also do a like a mind body behavioral assessment is another way to go, and just look at where we're strong and where we're weak. Look where we're not fully showing up. Are we procrastinating anywhere? Okay. So there's forces that are keeping, quote, the pulling back or the resistance in place.
Mm-hmm.
Can we work with those forces? Can we like deconstruct them and tease apart the elements and then take them down into vibrating space? And if we do that, we're that much freed from them. They may come back up again, but they're gonna, over time, come up less and less. And when they do come up, they can be processed quicker and quicker. That's the general pattern. So there's lots of ways, lots of skills to work on projection, or traditionally that would be associated in Buddhism with just wrong view.
Yeah.
It's basically they would say that you just have a deluded view.
Yeah.
And
And
lots of ways to work with that at various scales, again.
yeah, that's really cool because it
Various
is.
modalities at various skills.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like those modalities do equate talking therapy. It's obviously a gross level that I know there's some contention. Not long ago, I read Alan Watts' Psychotherapy East and West, and he's quite critical of like Western talking therapy in terms of not getting to the root cause, to the root issue. But then it does have a place, clearly. Like it clearly has a place and go into the root through
Well, it's whatever work,
meditation.
it's whatever works.
Yeah.
It's like you find something that works, great. Why would anybody argue with what's worked for you?
Yeah, and also it could like combination. It might not be one modality. It might be a combination of different modalities that work in conjunction with each other, and that kind of thing.
Definitely. And that's why I pair the grow up and the wake up, or the psychological relational with the transcendent. That's the integration piece. We either go, I mean, we don't always get to choose. Some people just like have a transcendent experience. They don't even have a practice. It just happens to them. Some people practice towards that and a transcendent experience happens, and they haven't really matured the psychological relational piece. So they'll have to do that to have a balanced, quote, enlightenment. Other people, they do the psychological relational, and that provides an optimal foundation to work with the transcendent. However, for some of those people who have a mature psychological relational, they may not have a driver or an impulse to go to the transcendent. So there's that. So whether, sometimes there's this question of, well, should I do the psychological relational first or the transcendent first? And we don't always get to choose. I will say, if you get sufficiently resourced in your ability to self-regulate, then that's takes care of a bunch of issues around any reactions to the pure transcendent experience. So that can be super helpful. And they can happen side by side. A person can be using techniques that kind of orient them in the direction of transcendence. And they can also be learning how to self-regulate and getting super resourced in working with their own reactivity. So that can happen that way too. There isn't one fit.
I really appreciate that framing. And one of the reasons why, like re I was writing an article on the progressive path versus the direct path recently, and attempting to contextualize or kind of bring them together with the models that we have of mental health, mental illness, depression, anxiety, whatever that, however that may manifest, with the assumption that at a base level, again, to go down on scale, if something is quote unquote true at scale, whether it's a Hindu philosophy or psychotherapy, if they're tapping into some kind of true mechanism or organic process, there'll be some similarity between the models, if that makes sense. So For example, like with Jungian psychology, you've got the complexes that relate nicely to samskaras. And there's Leanne Whitney, her book Patanjali and Jung is a great synthesis of those. But point being, to cut a long story short, and I think it's really empowering for people in the overlap of mental health, is almost I feel that you can have an upper hand if you've really struggled with your mental health and you've had no choice to do the psychological emotional work. Because if you've done that, A, that there's a real humbling quality. And it's almost like you go for that humbling process, and then an awakening experience, it can be redeeming, but it can also like ground you in the practices that you already have in a way that grounds you. That's just been my experience. Like it's almost as if therapy, like doing a lot of shadow work or just understanding your emotions, integration can be part of a progressive path of awakening. Whereas sometimes it's almost framed as completely distinct and like you're at a at least I felt like with spirituality and hearing certain teachers talk about bliss, and I'm like, I just want to feel normal. Like I can't even feel normal right now. So how do I get to bliss? And I think there is a really empowering perspective on
By the
like
way,
these.
can you teach me to get to normal?
I haven't got a clue what normal is. I've
Yeah,
got a clue.
so part of what comes to mind is first of all how fortunate a person is to be able to do that psychological relational work. Not everybody's in a position to do it. Whether it's, they're just not resourced enough financially, or it's not available so much where they are, although there's online now, so that's possible. So that's part of it. But at another way of looking at it is, well, two things. The first is whatever you work through in your, let's say, therapy work. Every time you work through something, you're that much freer. So, from that perspective, in the long game, you could look at that as you're that much more awake. You're that much more lighter as opposed to heavier in what in the mula kleshas that you're carrying around, and how that fabricates up the chain into whatever behaviors those are driving. So there's that piece. But the other piece is whatever suffering you experience, one of the hallmarks of awakening experiences, depending on what stage you're at, but the general hallmark is you lose a chunk of suffering. Now that can be gradually, the gradual path, you chip away at it and you quote get lighter and lighter and lighter and lighter, or you have a sudden experience. Hey, yesterday I was a different person, that kind of thing. But you've lost a chunk of suffering, whatever that is. And the value of suffering that happened before you lost that chunk of suffering is now it's just a memory. But it's if you suffered a lot, it's a strong imprint. And then when you look out and see parts of your larger self walking around in the world, you can have empathy, and it's like if they only knew, it doesn't have to be that way. They don't have to be limited to the heaviness that's currently clogging up their body, mind, behavioral way of being in the world. And so because you know that, because you've been through that and you have that strong memory, that kind of empathy leads, can lead, strongly leads, often leads to compassion. And a seed that blossoms into wanting to help others. Because if they only knew. And that, roughly speaking, is, the path of the Bodhisattva.
There's a I really like the way you articulated that, because there's like a I'm using this loosely, but almost more of like a Abrahamic or like biblical suffering that maybe lacks some of the non-dual, to use that word, but like the freedom liberation aspect. But what, like kind of, and Jungian, like, because obviously Jung was very much motivated by Christianity, where hardship, the pressure of hardship really makes you an individual, and you can flourish through hardship, and you can smooth out those rough edges and actually become, like you say, really someone that can empathize. There's that aspect of suffering that is actually redeeming in its own right. But then the Buddhist or more kind of liberated traditions, you don't have to suffer in that way. It's like it's a really interesting play between those two. Because it's almost I this could be my bias, but I there is a certain depth that people get through suffering, I find. Like when I meet someone of a certain depth, I know I can usually tell like they've gone places, they've seen shit. Like it's palpable. And I think that makes for a great teacher for people in helping professions. The opposite, sometimes there are occasionally teachers where you can feel them almost at surface level. And perhaps that does translate as lacking a bit of genuine empathy and understanding for when people are in a really dark place through their spiritual growth, through their meditation practice. So I really like that framing of suffering. It's almost like you can lighten the load, but at the same time, you almost have gratitude towards the suffering you experienced in the past, because that's made you who you are. And at every level on your own path, there's someone that exists, many people that exist at that level now.
Yeah, it
And you can reach.
sensitized you to the human condition. And that sensitization will be in kind of two directions. One is the human condition that's problematic for people, the body mind behavioral conditioning that's problematic and creates suffering, and then the usual experience of, in Buddhism they call it the difference between the first and the second arrow. So the first arrow is that the human condition will naturally, no matter how awake or liberated you are, include pain, include discomfort, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The issue is if you don't, or the dynamic is if you don't have reactivity to that, which is the second arrow. It's the reactivity that creates the suffering. If you have the direct experience of the pain or discomfort without the reactivity, then that's the human condition experienced without the overlay of suffering. It still hurts, but it's not problematic like what gets added with all the reactivity.
That is, I think that's one of, if not the most important clarifications, in a sense of, because I've seen you, I know you've spoken about this, the misconception that pain goes away is a big one. And is it, I've thought about this before, like surely it's more liberating to be able to experience pain and not be swayed by it, than to just, because if pain goes away, then so does other sensation like happiness and joy and pleasure. So then you're saying, what would you want to be numb to experience? Like take out pain, but take out pleasure. So then you're numb.
Take out your aliveness.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
And
So
so the beauty of, in a way, the beauty of it, of the integrated
I just
spiritual
enlightened
path
myself.
or enlightenment or whatever you want to call it, the beauty of it is that although there is some evidence around telomeres that suggests that they're in better, they get in better condition, so there may be an influence on lifespan. The beauty of it actually is maybe there's that, but it's not that. The beauty is we can more fully be alive.
Yeah.
We experience more of life directly, and we're not caught as much in our reactivity, which takes us away from the direct experience.
That as well is another seeming paradox in terms of the way in which, like, the term spiritual bypassing is becoming increasingly popular, and how the idea of transcendence, moving away from pain, ignoring pain, is one way that spirituality is essentially misused, not including
It's not
exactly.
including the human condition.
It's not including it because it's actually natural and a revealing process, if not interfered by certain belief systems or suppression, would reveal that aliveness. So more of the challenge is actually to become, as you're saying, fully alive, but less reactive to the full spectrum of aliveness. And it's almost, in some way, it's almost the opposite of this caricature of enlightenment that we have, where it's just like unaffected. I mean, I'm mixing terms now because you could say that's reactivity, but fully feeling, fully grieving as you're going through a healing.
Becoming a person of complete feeling. It's not about the disappearance of feeling, it's about the working through of the reactive proliferation of unwholesome mind-body states to the direct experience of earlier temporal processing. Experiencing pain as pain without the reactivity, without the conceptual story, is earlier temporal processing.
Because you catch it before the reactivity
Because
in that
you're
space.
metabolizing it before it has to further fabricate into story making. And mirrors facing mirrors, and you're all of a sudden you're down a rabbit hole and you've been in a mood for 3 days. That is not a happy mood. So it doesn't have to proliferate and fabricate down the rabbit hole of unwholesome mind-body behaviors. And
And
that's the difference between the first arrow and the second arrow, or in this case, the third arrow and the fourth arrow and the fifth arrow and the sixth arrow.
the infinite stream of arrows just nonstop. With like relating this, and I'll draw us to a close shortly. So an hour and a half, but I would love to do a part two because I've got more questions now than I did at the beginning. So if you'd be happy to do that another time, that would be an honor. But something I was just going to add there was to bring that back to what we were discussing with subtle and gross layers to
Gross, subtle, and
experience,
very subtle.
gross, subtle, and very subtle, and emptiness. Experientially, I've noticed how the more that like that in my environment that experience is applied, that the same can apply to pain as well. So you can not only do you not have the reactivity, you can experience the spaciousness in pain.
Sure.
And this is a question that I have around this.
That's basic Mahayana, by the way, is that everything is empty and that everything includes pain. So can you ex another way to say it is, can you experience pain and feel fundamentally okay? I
Can
say
you?
fundamentally okay. Shenzhen has his own term for it. He says happiness independent of conditions, but it's, I mean it the same way. And that's the fulfillment component of enlightenment, is that you can be, perfectly fulfilled, just quote, sipping on emptiness. And you still have to show up in the world and be functional.
And I wonder as well, because it's something I've experienced, which is counterintuitive and actually confusing at times as well, which is,
At the conventional scale.
at the
That's
conventional
where
scale.
confusion is, by
That's exactly,
the
trying to marry them together, what's going on. But it's similar to emptiness, and you mentioned joy. Being able to be connected to joy when in a painful situation, the reason that's confusing is because conventionally that can feel like you're some kind of psychopath. You're like, why have I got access to joy in this situation while simultaneously maybe like going through a difficult experience? Or
Well, that can happen though at the conventional scale as well.
that's true.
I mean, so I'm a pickleball guy. Okay. So when I play pickleball, my body can really hurt. And yeah, I'm going to be 64 next month, so I'm not a spring chicken. So my body can only do certain things, and sometimes it hurts to do those things. And pickleball is so much fun. For me, it's like 2 hours. It's like a 2 hour joy session. You get the social connection, so you get that kind of part fulfilled, but it's just so much damn fun. Everybody's like laughing on the court. When we're not like, crazy competitive. We're more like we're in it because it's fun and it's joyful. And there's also pain. It also hurts. And that's just like a conventional thing that everybody in that well, the older people, particularly on that pickleball court, experience joy and pain in the same quote session. So it's not unusual.
That's true, yeah. I think it's also that the temptation to be binary with experience, like this is a bad experience. This shouldn't include feelings of joy or feelings of ease.
Multiple perspectives can integrate with each other.
I am loving this conversation. I'm going to draw us to a close. You've probably noticed that I'm like sat in darkness because I didn't preempt. I've endarkened myself right this. As I said, I'd love to talk again like this. I really enjoy talking with you and your perspective on things, your clarity across these dimensions as well. I think is so useful for people. And very grounded and practical. And I really thank you for taking the time today.
Yeah, you're welcome. And I hope it's useful to others as well.
Oh, I'm absolutely certain it will be. Yeah, I trust the process that I think there'll be people at their own stage that will get different things from different parts of the conversation. But personally, I've really, I've been illuminated in different areas, and it's helped me contextualize like some of my experiences, which is incredibly valuable. So thank you.
Cool. Cool. Yeah, you're welcome. Pleasure. Yeah, thanks for doing what you do. I appreciate it. You have a lot of wonderful content on your podcast that I think would be good for people to check out.
Oh,
And
thank
so
you.
what I checked out, I really liked. So thank you for doing that.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It really it's a labor of love, and it's taking time to get off the ground, but this is for me like one of the best things to do, have these kind of conversations and get to share it and hopefully help people in the process. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mind That Ego podcast. To stay up to date, you can join the Mind That Ego mailing list if you head to mindthatego.com/MFM. You'll also get a copy of my book, Mindsets for Mindfulness, when you join. You can also follow Mind That Ego on Facebook and YouTube, where the podcasts are also displayed in video format, along with other inspired videos that I create. Or if Instagram is more your social media of choice, you can follow me at Ricky_DeRizz. That's DERIZZ.